Hi, I'm Brett Johnson, former United States Most Wanted cyber criminal, now good guy, and host of The Brett Johnson Show. Today's episode is episode number 78, Brad Gorka Talks Security on The Brett Johnson Show. When we come back. Oh yeah. Now are you in Atlanta proper or what?
No. I'm way up in the northern suburbs.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you get to avoid most of the traffic?
Usually, yeah. I try and avoid going down to the city. I had to go Wednesday for well, I didn't have to. The FBI was doing a little 1-day conference,
right,
downtown. So I went to that. But normally I avoid it like the plague.
Yeah, I spoke at that conference back in, I think, 2018, 2019, something like that. The Atlanta one. Actually, I had the night before I got kidney stones. So here I am with kidney stones, and I didn't think I was going to be able to make it. And I told him, I was like, look, I'm going to try to make it in, and put me a chair on stage. That way I could just sit and give my presentation, if nothing else. And actually made it through it. I was, after that, I went straight to the doctor. But man, I'd never had that before. And you talk about pain. Good Lord.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm already recording. I just do that in case anything pops up of interest before the show proper starts. But what we'll do is I got your email this morning. I think that's an excellent topic to talk about. I also want to talk about data and privacy.
Okay.
Touch upon that a bit. I think that's about it. I figure so 45, 60 minutes total. And this episode will be out. I'll put this out this coming Tuesday on the show. So what I'm doing is I'm transitioning to Brett Johnson Show. It's still going to be me doing some solo stuff too. But I want to start interviewing people as well, security professionals, law enforcement, bring in some felons as well, things like that, and just see if I can grow the subscriber base into something that this show's actually making some money, because it's not right now.
Yeah, well, it can be tough to monetize this stuff.
Oh, it's horrible.
You know, my boss, he said, don't name who you work for by name. So I'll just kind of dance around that a little
That's fine.
And, you know, it's, you know, security leader, former CISO, you know, all that stuff. If you're looking for people to potentially bring on, at the conference Wednesday, they had a guy and if you don't like this person, just forget I said anything.
I think person may have reached out to me.
Oh, okay. Eugene Levetsky.
Yes.
Okay.
What did you think of him? This is the first time I met him.
Yeah. First time I had met him too. You know, he just kind of talked about, hey, here's how hackers do their thing.
Okay.
And, you know, going onto the marketplaces, finding the, you know, stolen credentials for sale, and then buying an exploit. You know, he just kind of took us through the typical process. I didn't really hear much about his story. He only gave us like this little teeny sliver of that. But it hasn't been long since he changed sides.
So how long?
I asked him, and I think he said he got out of prison April 2019, so it's, I guess, about 4 years now, and he's trying to start a real consulting firm, and it's tough to get that kind of thing off the ground.
It is.
And I know how, you know, when I heard your story at Quantico and have just kind of followed you, I understand that it's, you know, it's easier to make money illegally than it is legally. And I thought, and I don't know what this guy's full story is, but he seems legit.
Okay. And that was my main concern. I was going to ask you, was he forthright? Did he seem contrite?
He did. Okay. Oh yeah. And I mean, the little bit of background he gave us was that, there is no amount of, after going through prison, he said, there is no amount of money on this earth that is worth me going back to prison again. But I know it, you know, it can be tempting, you know,
to
slide back into that. And so I thought just having you as somebody that can totally relate, and you almost need, like, I feel like you guys should have like a support group to kind of help.
Agree.
And you talked about how you'd hit up other FBI agents and stay in touch and just to keep you on the straight and narrow. So I thought I would make the introduction to you too. And I was just like, cause I know in that world, sometimes you get along and sometimes you don't at all. And so I was just hoping that when I talked to Brett Johnson, he would have been like, fuck that guy. I hate him. Yeah. He stole 100 grand from me, or yeah. Who knows, you know?
So what, which market did he run? Do you know? Did he say?
He didn't say. He didn't get into very much of that.
Yeah.
It was mostly about just, you know, telling the class how hackers work.
Yeah. The night that conference was over, he sent me an email saying that you had mentioned my name, and he said, you know, I used to run a market that was much smaller than the one that you had. Just wanted to touch base with you. And I corresponded with him. I didn't know the guy. And it's interesting that you said support group, because I believe that stuff too. I think that, you know, you get people that have had those similar experiences in prison and trying to turn their lives around. If they're serious about it, a support network is absolutely a necessity. The problem that I've had is that, you know, I get these former felons that reach out to me and they say they want to turn their lives around, but at the same time, they're doing some bullshit in the background. So, I one of the things that I found out is that you really can't serve two masters. You've got to make that choice to know, yes, I can make more money. I can steal more money doing illegal things and profit like that. And I'm going to, I'll end up with a lot more cash in pocket, or I can just turn my back on that completely and take a chance on leading this legal life. And Brad, that's a really scary proposition. It is, especially for somebody that, I used to steal a lot of money, and I'm sure Eugene did as well. And when you've got that tool set in your background, and you're all of a sudden thinking, okay, I'm just going to set that aside and never use that again, and just take a chance that I'll make money and be all right this other way. That can be very scary. So I understand. I really understand these guys that are on Facebook groups or Telegram or what have you that I talk to kind of on the daily, that, you know, they want to turn their lives around, but they don't want to give up this other thing too until it gets there.
Yeah.
But you've got to be able to make that choice. I was told when I got out of prison, I was in this RDAP program, this cognitive behavioral therapy thing. And they make you go through some counseling sessions once you're out of prison as well. And the counselor, she was very good. She made the statement that recovery is never a straight line. You know, you're going to backslide, but as long as you're making that forward progress, you'll end up getting there. So I understand that, that it's a process for these guys. And that's why I was asking about Eugene. I, as long as he's contrite, as long as he came, through forthright and open, I'm more than agreeable to bring him on the show, to start talking to him, and help him out and everything else. I've got a buddy, I call him a buddy. He's the closest thing I've got, I guess. But his name is Matt Cox. He's down in Tampa, and he was a former U.S. Most Wanted, and he was a mortgage fraudster. I mean, a prolific mortgage fraudster. But Matt has Matt's got that tool set as well. I mean, he absolutely knows how to do it, and he's got the willingness to do it. But he's made that choice to not use that tool set anymore. And right now he's going through all that process of, trying to figure out how he's going to make that legitimate living. He's doing pretty well with it right now, but this is all a process that people like us have to go through. And I think if you don't make the choice, if you're not willing to accept the damage that you've caused your victims and be open about that, I think that's you're never going to get there. I really don't think that. So you have to be able to be willing to change, like the Michael Jackson song. But that's enough about Brett Johnson and the criminal world. Let's see. If you don't mind, I'll record an opening after we're through we're through recording today. But if you could just tell the audience who you are,
sure,
and give us some background from there, and we'll just dive into some topics.
All right. Brad Gorka. I am a have been an information security leader for 8 years now. Work at a very large food service company today. That's an international, large conglomerate. And prior to that, I worked at a Class 1 railroad, and before that, at an electronics manufacturer and software developer. And I've built security programs from the ground up. My first security, full-time security gig, they hired me, and I was the very first information security professional that they had. And I had to build that team from the ground up. I started with $0 and zero people, and it was a tough road, but I learned how to hire right and built a great culture there, and really turned it into something great. Went through a big merger, and I had to reset the whole program again, because what the other crew had versus my crew were just in two very different places. So we reset the whole program, redid it. And so been through some interesting stuff. I like building teams. I like problem solving, very analytical. Before that, I was a one-man IT show. So a small consulting firm. So I've done pretty much every IT job that exists to a certain degree.
Right.
Don't claim to be an expert in any one of those, but I have dabbled heavily in just about every IT job. And that has given me a great foundation to move into cybersecurity. And what I like to look for IT generalists, because I tell them, you spent a number of years learning how to build computers and build applications and maintain them. And now I'm going to help you use that knowledge to understand how the bad guys are going to tear them apart.
Oh, that sounds.
And cool. That strategy has worked really well. And I've picked up a number of guys in different IT departments and converted them into highly effective security operations analysts. Before that, I was a quantitative data analyst. So I'm very good at handling large volumes of data. That's also helped me out a lot in the security space. And when I was doing that one-man IT show, I got a graduate degree in IT management. And oddly enough, I have a bachelor's degree in psychology, which has nothing to do with tech. Yeah. And the running joke is that I tend to lean on the psychology training more than the graduate school. And a good friend of mine told me that the technology is usually the easy part. The tough part is the humans. And there's a lot of truth to that. And certainly with the psychology, you know, we're trying to change behaviors of people to get them to stop doing dumb stuff. But then I also use psychology in order to develop programs and build business cases to get the funding and the support that we need from executive leadership. And those things can be very challenging.
You know, it's funny you would say, you said get the funding and support you would need mm-hmm. from executive leadership, because you said you started, you know, building from the ground up these teams. And I was going to ask what type of difficulties you encountered building those teams.
Extensive. I think if you know, I've worked at three companies now that are, I would say, lightly regulated. I know we just had the SEC rules, Securities and Exchange Commission. Those just got authorized yesterday, and so that's gonna bring a lot of oversight and applicability to a lot of companies that haven't had much, but I, you know, I've worked at companies that haven't had a ton of regulation. And in those situations, you're fighting for budget just like every other director or VP that's out there. They all have legitimate needs, and so you have to make your case and go for it. If you are in a heavily regulated industry, like defense industrial base, financial, you know, some of these other ones that have a lot more onerous regulations, or just over the top customer requirements, the money tends to flow. Unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of companies that are still in the mode of, you know, we'll invest just enough to get by. And then they're gonna wait until they have a catastrophic cybersecurity incident, and then the money bags will get dropped off at the CISO's office. So it's tough. I try and run security like a business and recognize that companies got to make money. You know, if I go spend all the money, then we're in trouble. And it's not a blank check. And you've got to be thoughtful with how you spend, and you got to find ways to save. And when a company comes upon challenging times, which lots of them have over the past year or two, you know, the crazy thing that I've seen over the past year or two during this economic downturn is that there, you know, used to be, you know, once you built the ship, it was tough for leadership to take money from it.
Right.
Because if something did happen, they don't want to be the guy that said, well, we took 25% of their funding. That's not going to go over well. But here recently, the information security teams have not been spared. I've talked to people that have seen their entire functions wiped out. And they just outsource the whole thing. And I think that's a kind of a scary indicator of where we are at in the economy right now is that even those crews are not getting a pass. But it's not just the money, it's the support too. If you don't have that CEO level support, it can just be tough to get these programs to be successful. And I always try to get my CEO to sign the policies, not all of them, but certain ones. Because
so have they been pretty good about working with you on security and things like that?
Some have and some haven't.
Okay.
You know, I had one that was, you know, the program where I, you know, we actually had a change in CEO and we had a change in CIO as well. And that's when all the doors began to open because they gave me the support and they helped me get the funding. I had one CEO that was just phenomenal in terms of his support. Now he wanted to make sure that he fully understood, what was going on and what was coming next in terms of the security controls that we were lighting up. The guy was brilliant, you know, just a phenomenal engineer and became a great business leader. And as long as I was very transparent with him and forthright and everything else, he gave me so much support to the point that he signed up to be one of my guinea pigs when we were doing POCs. You know, if I was getting ready to implement some kind of new email defense or phishing protection or whatever, I go to him and say, you know, hey Bruce, can we sign you up for this? And he'd raise his hand. Yeah, put me on it. And that's phenomenal, because then when you do turn it on for everybody and some VP or senior vice president gets something blocked or gets irritated, you know, they'll call the CISO and be like, I need an exception. How about you turn this off for me? Or I don't like it. I think it's clunky and it sucks. You can say, listen, you know, we're not doing exceptions for this. All right, that's fine. I'll escalate it to the boss. That's fine. Go right ahead. Because he's going to say, well, I've been using it longer than anybody else. I think it's fine. You should be able to get your job done with it. You fall in line. Right. And so, you know, it's great to have that level of support and just confidence too. I mean, I think, it makes it more rewarding because it makes you feel like what you do matters and what you do is valued, and you don't always get that.
No, I agree with you. I've worked with companies where it's obvious that you're not valued.
Yeah.
And it makes a big difference. You, when you were talking about your work history, you worked in many different verticals. What's the difference in the primary focus in security across those different verticals?
You know, at the telecommunications manufacturer, it was really just overall corporate program maturity. You know, we had just kind of the basic stuff. Yeah, we had firewalls. Yeah, we had email security, but there wasn't really any third party risk management and security awareness. And so we had to build all that security awareness. You know, I'm really big on the fundamentals, and I believe that you've got to get those things right. You know, Chris Roberts crows about this stuff constantly, about this blinky light shit that's on the market. And, you know, every month there's some new gadget popping up, and it addresses some exotic threat
right
vector. And, you know, but I always tell people, you know, I used to dabble in that world when I was a teenager. And I understand that, for criminals, it's an investment of their time and resources. And so they're going to seek to minimize that. And so what that means is the old tricks are the best tricks because they still work.
Right.
So, you know, email security, you got to nail that. Patching and vulnerability management, you got to nail that. And security awareness training, you got to get going on that. It's the best bang for the buck out of everything we do. So those are really the starting points, and I feel you got to get that stuff right before you go chasing some of these more exotic things.
Right.
And you know, so I would say at the telecommunications place, it was, you know, really just getting the program right and growing that culture of security. Once I got to the railroad, though, I would say, you know, they already had a very strong culture of safety.
Okay.
And I think security played into that very well. And so I think the culture was already kind of there, but at that place it was, you know, the trains are running 24/7,
right,
365 days a year somewhere. And there's a lot of technology that makes all that work now, which is just amazed me. And so there it was all about keeping trains moving and preventing accidents and all that stuff. So there, I would say, you know, cyber security almost kind of bridged into the life safety kind of spot, you know, where things you got to maintain that integrity, maintain the uptime. And that was the name of the game, is that uptime. You know, where I'm at now is food service, you know, very different. And, you know, it's more on the services side than it is the actual, you know, food, the ingredients and stuff. You know, it's very different. You know, this is, we have a UK kind of, oversight company, you know, a parent company. And so I'm learning how to navigate that connection, which is something a little bit new for me. I'm not having to deal with the SEC right now, so that's interesting. But privacy is very, very important to them. We have a tremendous number of employees. This is, you know, the past two companies had about 20,000 employees each place. This one, it's 250,000, and that's just in North America. So I think when you factor in the whole world, it's way up there.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, privacy is very important to them because they're headquartered in the UK. Their GDPR is very important. And so we kind of run, even though we don't really have to do GDPR here in the North America area, you know, we still run it like that. And, you know, so I think taking care of our employees and where I'm at now, I'm really enjoying it. I've only been, I think this is my fourth or fifth week, and people are just, that's number one there. And so it's been a breath of fresh air because I feel like their leadership and the culture of the company just really values everybody. And, you know, so the culture is very different than what I've experienced in the past, and the program needs are different too. And I've got an opportunity to build a team up and build processes and capability more on the risk management side. than the technical side. And I've dealt with that stuff as the leader before. This is the first time where that's all I'm doing. And so I'm, you know, growing that, I'm trying to find ways to stay plugged in on the technical side too.
Let me ask you, I do want to talk about, you mentioned privacy. Going back to the railroad, when I served time, I was in Big Spring, Texas, and there was a gentleman there, a young man. He was in his, hell, he had been down for, at that point, he had been incarcerated, I guess, maybe 8 or 10 years. And he had about 20 more to go. But what he had done is when he was in college, he decided he wanted to pull a prank. He got on the railroad and he caused a train to derail. I don't know, I guess manually did it or what have you.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there are protections in place now, systems in place that can stop that type of thing from happening.
I don't know, stop, but there certainly are things that can detect, and I'm not going to get into everything that I learned and saw there, but sure. I think what's interesting is, you know, the gauge of the rails is the same as it's been for 200 years or whatever. And, you know, the mechanical aspect of it is relatively the same for the past, you know, a very long time.
Right.
But what technology has enabled railroads to do, in my opinion, is process more volume. You know, basically, it's, you know, it's like an airplane. It's not making any money if it's sitting on the tarmac. It makes money when it's flying in the air. And so these rails are kind of the same. You know, the more volume you can put, the more revenue you can get. And so technology has allowed railroad companies the ability to increase capacity while maintaining safety. And so we've got, you know, a lot of these things are built into safety systems and to help them operate and avoid accidents.
Right.
It still happens, of course, but if we went back 100 years, you know, they weren't running probably near the volume they are today, and they were able to pull off the same amount of safety, but it required a lot more humans. I mean, they used to have people that would actually just sit there and listen to the cars running by, because when they make a certain noise, that means there's a problem.
Okay.
And you want to check that out. You know, now we can use technology to do that at a very high scale and at a much faster rate.
Okay. Data and privacy. Now there's a topic.
Yep.
So why is it that Americans don't really care about their data or their privacy compared to, say, people in the UK?
Yeah, and I, you know, I've worked with like folks in Germany and France, and I tell you what, they take shit real seriously over there. You know, I think it just has to do with a lot of it is economics, and we've had a few exchanges about that. Is this country seems somewhat obsessed with acquiring cheap gadgets and trinkets and stuff, and we just, you know, we're very very cost conscious people,
right.
And we're always looking to save a buck. And you know, if we're buying a new 50-inch TV and this one's, you know, $800 and this one's $600, and it's like, well, I'm going to save the money. They look the same specs, except, you know, one of them, all the software was developed in China, and you know, it hasn't been put through any kind of security tests or anything, and they're never going to update it. And you're going to hook it up to the internet with your work computer and work, you know, everything else you've got in your house that's listening to everything that you're saying. And I think, so that's part of it. The other thing is just the convenience of this stuff. You know, I think there's a sense that people think it enriches their life because it saves them time or it makes things more convenient. And you know, certainly if you've got kids or a busy job or whatever else, like if there's some piece of technology that can save 15 minutes of your day, you know, you'll probably strongly consider it or just jump right on board. And so there's kind of this aspect of convenience and cost that I think you're sacrificing your privacy for it. And even, you know, when I think about years ago, set-top boxes from your TV company, when they started having these DVRs, I just kind of assumed that they're analyzing everything I'm watching.
Right.
And they know that, you know, our household tends to like, you know, stuff like Jack Ryan and all these other, you know, TV shows. And, but I was just like, who cares? Like, I don't care if you want to see what I'm watching on TV. Like, I just, you know, if you want to analyze that and recommend shows to me, go for it, you know. But now it has gotten like just way over the top. Now they're tracking your location everywhere you go. They're recording all the searches that you've done. And I mean, some of it is just downright frightening. You know, having a private conversation with your spouse, and then the next day, they're getting directed ads on Instagram about a conversation that you thought was private. Right. And it's so non-transparent too. And that's the difference between Europeans and us, is that in Europe, you can't get away with this shit anymore. You've got to be totally upfront and tell people what you're collecting, why you're collecting it, what you're doing with it, how long you're going to keep it, and everything else. And the data subject, the citizen, has a lot of control over that stuff. But here it's just this, you know, 16 page terms of service, and you don't really have an option. If you want to use the service, you have to agree to it. And if you can't agree to it, which, I mean, nobody's going to actually read all that stuff, but there is no continue without consenting to that. It's accept or go away.
Right.
And, you know, I have a hard time with that stuff. And there are times now where I'm just like, all right, I guess I'm just not going to use it. But the technology that collect, you know, we're in the data age and the AI age, and data is monetized, and it's right. How these places make money now. And they will collect as much of it as they possibly can. And they will, it's like it feels like they're very sneaky about it, because it's buried in the terms of service. And the, you know, I tell people, like, I don't just drop apps on my phone on a whim because of all the crap that it does, and it's monitoring and everything else. And it doesn't have anything to do with what the app's about.
Right.
So, and, you know, why are you tracking my look? You know, go ahead.
You mentioned the terms of service, and, you know, a couple of weeks ago we had the report came out that a few of these tax services had been sharing financial data with Google and Meta. And I think it was you that made the point that, hey, what are you going to do about it? You agreed to it in the terms of service. And, you know, that really hit home, because you're right. Most people, they do not read terms of service. They want to use whatever website or app that is. So they just go ahead and accept. And I'm wondering how we get to the point where we're, where we can convince the populace, and not only the populace, but also, you know, the legislators, that data and privacy needs to be respected and is important in this country.
Yeah, I mean, as many breaches as we've experienced in this company, and I think when it comes to privacy, the two biggest ones for me was the Equifax breach and the OPM breach.
Right.
And after those, you would have thought that maybe would have been a wake-up call, but I don't think it was, because we're still having these problems. But for me, I wish we could just have more options. Like when the tax stuff is crazy though, because they were all doing it. So it's not like if one of them charged a little bit more, but didn't do it. Okay. I've got an option. You know, if you actually read the whole terms of service and you said, I'm not okay with that, I can go to the competitor and spend a few bucks more and not have my information sold off like that. But it's, we don't really have a lot of options in the market, and the individual companies don't give an option. I wish that that would be a path forward, is to say, option A is it's $10 and we do whatever we want with your information. Option B is we keep it all private, but you got to pay $30 instead of 10. Okay, I'll shell out that money. I'm okay with that. Or just the other one is competitors, competition in the marketplace that treats it more seriously and has a better privacy program and honest practices in place. But again, we're so cheap in this country. Like, are they going to be, is that a viable business model? And I don't think it is right now. People like you and me would absolutely pay the extra money for that. But I think we're in the minority there. I don't think enough people are going to take that to make their business profitable. And then they're going to be like, geez, we're going to go out of business if we don't do something. Okay, well, guess what? We can sell this data and make a few million bucks on it a year.
That's exactly what happens, right?
And it's all getting shared too. I mean, you know, like the little gadgets plug into your car, and you know, the insurance company says, you know, we'll save you 10% if you plug this thing into your car.
Yeah, I got
that. Would be highly problematic for my insurance coverage, but it's like,
I'll tell you what happened with me. My wife, we've got insurance through USAA, and we added a new vehicle, and we got a new Acura MDX, the Type S, great vehicle.
Nice.
It's nice. Yeah. But we're adding it on, and USAA, they're like, you know, we're going to be increasing your insurance, and we're like, okay, what's it going to run? And the amount is $1,000 a month, and I'm
wow.
Like, what? so we've got. We've got, like, because the boys have cars and all this. So we have four or five cars on the thing, plus our house and all that. But still, I'm like, man, that's high. And the agent, she's like, well, you know, we can take 30% off of the bill. And I was like, well, how do you do that? And well, you download this app to your phone where we track everything you do when you're driving. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm like, everything.
Yeah,
like, well, yeah, it's you have to leave it running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and you give access to everything. And I'm like, you know, I think I'll pay $1,000 a month. So 30%, that's a significant discount. That truly is, but I can't justify that type of app running on your phone. And, you know, it's not just insurance. I use that as an example, but, you know, TikTok is highly invasive with everything that it records. It's not just the Chinese companies. It's Facebook. It's Google. I mean, everyone, at least in the United States, it's as long as you've got some sort of widget that makes people happy, they tend to give up whatever you want them to give up in order to access that. And, you know, I'm of the opinion these days that since the populace won't or doesn't care about their own privacy, that it's up to the legislators to do that. The problem is that the legislators, they simply don't understand the tech. So we're going to get, you know, we'll get legislation in there that is ill-informed and uneducated and overreaching or underreaching. And I'm not sure how we solve that, Brad.
I don't know either. I mean, just the level of surveillance that goes on right now is just staggering. A while back, the book 1984 was mandatory reading for people to get out of high school, at least around here it was. And, I plan on having my kids read that book when they're old enough. I think the many ways that stuff can be exploited, by our adversaries or by whoever. It's just the sheer amount of it and the amount of sharing that goes on is just out of control. And once you stick AI on this stuff, like, God help us. Like, what's going to happen when a criminal organization hacks into one of these insurance companies and takes all of that location data that they've been collecting? You know, they say it's running 24/7. They told you the app runs 24/7. I mean, my God, how long do you think they're storing this stuff for?
Right.
And because the other thing is, humans, the way we build systems, we don't build systems to delete data ever. We just collect. and so, like, is it, even if they tell you a year, well, is it really gone after a year?
Right.
But can you imagine if, you know, AI, or if a criminal organization had their AI, stole that location data, trained the AI on it, and then just made that available as a service to criminals? Oh, you want to know where Brad Gorka, you know, what his travel habits look like, and, you know, where he's going to be at on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m. or, you know, whatever else. I mean, that's a pretty scary thought. And, you know, all this other stuff that goes with it too, you know, it's just, you know, I think we used to give it a free pass because, oh, it's just marketing. They're just feeding ads to us and stuff. But, you know, for a criminal, and it's, what bad things can I do with this? And right. And that's where my head always goes to, is what can a criminal do with this to either steal my money or cause a safety issue or whatever else? And so I don't know. And, you know, maybe the older generation that's currently running shit in this country can't really wrap their head around a lot of this stuff. I think that could be part of it. But I think hopefully as we get, hopefully some younger leadership that gets it a little bit more, or in a lot of cases, you know, there's just so many victims at this point. Eventually you're going to get somebody in office, hopefully, that's like, you know, I lost every dime I had to, you know, fraud, or it happened to my parents and it cleaned them out. You know, hopefully the leadership starts taking it a lot more seriously, but somebody's going to have to pay at the end of the day. It is not free. And that's what people are going to have to wake up to, is, you know, I know we got these new regulations coming from SEC and these other things, but it ain't free. And you know, businesses are not just going to eat the cost. It's kind of like, you know, the saying, when taxes get raised, you know, they're not going to pay that difference. They're just going to raise costs, and they're still going to make their earnings per share and whatever else. And so that's the tough side of it.
You had you'd mentioned some of the guidelines and stuff that's going on now. You, this morning, you sent me a thing regarding IoT devices.
Yeah.
So you want to talk about that, and do you think it'll do any good?
I haven't read a ton into it. I'm interested in how it's going to be policed. And I think I did see something about if they bust you using it and you're not meeting the requirements, there's going to be heavy fines for it.
So there's going to be a tag that says that this IoT device is compliant to said level. And that's.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's trying to remember what they called it. Where is it? It's kind of like the Energy Star certifications that they put on products, and it's going to be that for the IoT, and they're covering routers, home routers specifically, as its own category.
I mean, that would be good, because anyone who's watched me speak, I throw out this statistic that 41% of all the routers have the default password on there.
Yeah. Yeah. Just go to Showdam and have fun.
There you go.
I think it will help, at least just raising the awareness to put it out there so that people are like, what's this? And, you know, maybe that'll get people to even think about it. Maybe they'll never spend the extra $20 that the router costs versus the junky one. I think it's good to at least have people to, you know, raise the awareness that some of this stuff is junk and some of it is made with better quality. The one thing that I saw was, you know, I guess you've got to commit to maintaining software updates on it. And that costs money.
Oh yeah.
And you know, these, I think that we used to build these things to last a very long time, but now the technology changes so rapidly. I think we need to get to a point where we can accept that these things are somewhat disposable.
Right.
And I hate filling up landfills with this crap. And I just hate how wasteful that is. But I think, you know, a lot of these companies are just going to say, I mean, there's so much cost to maintain the software. They can't just do that for 10 years. Right. They'll go out of business. And it's, you know, some of these things that may end up having like a expiration date where they just self-destruct after 5 years, because the companies just, they've got to have an exit strategy so that they can continue to innovate. So it's like they get praised and they get financially rewarded for innovating in these things, but then they have all this cost to continue to maintain it. And so that can't be indefinite.
I hadn't even thought about that point that you're making right now, but on the guidelines that are being proposed, have you seen that there's a time limit where updates have to be for so many years or anything like that?
No, I didn't see that in there, but okay. Knowing the government, they probably screwed that up.
Probably.
I don't know. But they should have that kind of an out, to say, like, after 5 years, we're not going to do it. You know, there's a company that makes home surveillance cameras that got into some trouble recently because they said, look, we're not going to support this free subscription we used to offer, and we're not going to keep doing these updates. And there was this huge uproar. And I think, you know, some federal agency may have gotten involved too. And they had to kind of walk back some of that stuff. But it's like, you know, you can't just, company can't afford. Because I've been on that side of it. I've been on the business side of it. And it's expensive. Now maybe that's where AI can help us. Maybe that is something that AI, you know, I think one of the big opportunities with it is in this area of software development. So maybe you use the expensive human developers to build the thing originally, but once it's no longer a mainstream product, maybe we can stick an AI platform on top of that to maintain the software and to put it, you know, it's like, we're not building new features or anything like that, but we will deal with the security stuff. And maybe we can use AI to cheaply do that, meet the requirements of this new IoT certification program, and have your cake and eat it too, because we've got to find a way to make the economics of it work.
I mean, it makes sense. It really does. I hadn't even considered that aspect of things. And you're absolutely right. Just the upkeep on these items would absolutely bankrupt a company. You're trying to develop new products and services, and meanwhile, you're having to upkeep something that maybe is 8 or 10 years old.
I mean, well, like a boat anchor.
Yeah. So I could absolutely see, you know, buying products that have an expiration date on them. You know, it's good.
Yeah.
It's good for 3 years. After that, we're done.
But, you know, if you're going to do that, it's got to, you know, hopefully companies will be very transparent and not bury that in the terms of service that nobody reads. But, you know, that should be right next to the certification stamp. You know, IoT certified product, by the way, plan to buy a new one in 3 years because this thing is going to quit working. But, you know, we do that with smoke detectors. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're aware, but they have some kind of internal clock in them now, and after 10 years they will start beeping at you, and it's not because the battery died, it's because they've reached the end of their usable life. There's a chemical inside of them that degrades, and so it'll start beeping, and it will not stop beeping until you put it in your trash outside of your house.
That may have been what happened with me the other day.
Yeah, it'll drive you insane.
Oh, it did.
Yeah, but that's a new thing. I mean, I think that that feature has only been out for 5 to 10 years or something. Used to
Okay.
be, the builder would put it in the house and it'd be there 50 years later if you'd never changed it. But somebody figured that out a while back, and so now they expire. And maybe that is the path forward.
Now you made we're going to wrap it up here in a minute, but you made a really interesting point about when we were talking about cost of products and potential expiration dates, and then the use of AI, it being handed off to some sort of AI system that would continue to update these systems for set periods of time. That's absolutely a benefit of these AI type systems. What other types of benefits can you see on the good guy's side? And then how do you see, because I got to tell you, Brad, I've done a few presentations recently and I've been asked, what about AI on the criminal side? And like I was in
Endless
Guatemala,
possibilities.
endless, absolutely endless. And for example, I was in Guatemala about a week and a half ago, and prior to getting there, they had asked me, can you talk about AI and financial systems? I was like, yeah, but understand now that right now it's in its birth phase. Criminals aren't really using it a lot. And then lo and behold, the day before the presentation, I read this thing about Worm GPT, and I'm like, oh, and I'm in the process of getting a copy of getting access to Worm GPT now. I should have it hopefully by the end of the day, and I'll share that with you when I do. But so now we've got these GPT systems that criminals are using to build code, to come up with phishing emails, maybe handing off doing a lot of the stuff that humans would do previously, until you hand it off to the actual human that needs that, pulls the trigger on information access, data, or cash. So could you talk about AI for a few minutes about both on the good guy's side and the bad guy's side?
Yeah, I think one cool thing that we can use it for on the risk management side of the house is on risk assessments and threat assessments. A lot of those can be very time consuming if you want to be quantitative about it, or at least semi quantitative, or run any kind of calculations. Because you've got to go try and find historical artifacts that can give you some data to feed into those models. And for an analyst to do all that research is very time consuming. And if we can use AI to help come up with probabilities and predictions and expected financial losses and things like that, it would just be a huge time saver. And I think I don't think it's going to replace all the jobs and the GRC side of information security. But I think we talked about how hard it is to get support and resources and funding and things like that. And I think when you're in one of these business areas or sectors that industries that is not heavily regulated, there's always kind of this amount of work that we can never seem to have enough resources to get to. And I think AI has a great potential to allow us to scale up with the existing resources we've got to get to all that shit we didn't have time for, which would be great. I think on the technical side of things, the criminals are already beginning to use AI, and our adversaries, namely Russia and China, they're there. They've probably been there. And the only way that we are going to defeat that offense is with the same defense. I'm really big on when I manage security operations team, I am relentlessly pursuing a low mean time to resolution. Thinking like the hacker does and how they tend to move and operate and the sequence of events and stuff, I really drive into those people's heads. You've got to interrupt their attack as quickly as possible. And you got to shut all these doors, and you got to do this as fast as you can to minimize the damage and contain it. And I was thinking the other day about how we're starting to use automation and playbooks to speed those things up and enrich data with other data from other sources. And that and so thinking about just how much, you know, but we haven't drastically sped that up. You know, instead of maybe taking an analyst an hour, maybe it takes the analyst 15 minutes. But when I think about the other side of it, on the criminal side, and, you know, doing phishing to get account takeover and get valid credentials, and then going and finding their VPN front door, and then, you know, finding vulnerabilities that can be exploited, and then escalation of privileges, all these different steps in the attack chain, they take time.
Right.
But if I can use AI to run my playbook, and it can do a lot of the thinking, the amount of time that it will take to run an exploitation soup to nuts is going to get cut way, 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 way down. The only humans are not going to be able to operate that fast. And so we're going to have AI on the defensive side that can analyze in real time at machine speed and interrupt an attack, because there's just humans are not going to be able to deal with that. We are not fast enough. And so I think that it's going to accelerate the drastically accelerate the amount of the shortness of time on the attack side, and we've got to be able to keep up with it on the defense side.
Brad Gorka, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you coming on the show, man.
I appreciate you having me. I was excited to get the invite, and nice hanging out with you again.
So you will come back, yes?
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So,
and I was hoping to have a cool background, but you know, people get so sensitive these days that you never know what's going to set somebody off. So,
you know, there's a lot of truth to that. I had someone that was they complained about the fish guy in the back at one point.
Oh yeah.
So I don't.
It's a fish out of water. Why is a fish out of the water?
Look, man, you are outstanding. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We'll get this out ASAP, and keep up the good work you're doing. All right, so that was episode number 78 of the Brett Johnson Show. I want to thank Brad Gorka once again for coming on and talking to me. He is absolutely outstanding. The man is amazing in security and just overall life. So, Brad, thank you once again. Hey, if you like the show, please subscribe. If you don't like the show, please subscribe. We're trying to get the show. We're changing up a few things. As you notice, I'm doing more interviews now. I'm going to keep doing the solo show as well, but we're going to bring in a variety of different people to talk and discuss different types of matters, security, law enforcement, the prison life, things like that. And we're just trying to get the show up to the point where it's generating some income, because, hey, it would be nice if the Brett Johnson Show made some money. That being said, we're going to continue to do the solo show as well, because I like to talk. So please subscribe. Let me know what you like about the show. Let me know what you don't like about the show. If you want to be a guest, let me know. If you want to have somebody on as a guest, if you've got an idea of, hey, Brett, you should talk to this guy or this woman, let me know. I'll bring them on. We'll have that conversation. I'm Brett Johnson. We're going to close out the show. How do we close it out? We close it out the same way every single time. Stay safe, stay secure, stay vigilant. More importantly, this is the Brett Johnson Show. At the end of the day, just do the right damn thing. I'm Brett Johnson. Thank you for listening. Until next time.